Dover, Delaware, 1999. Two people are stabbed and killed in victim one's house. Within 11 minutes of arriving, police have already named person A a suspect and started issuing bolos and labeling them a person of interest. Now, person A did have domestic violence claims against them by victim one, but police only looked at suspect A, overlooking suspect B. And when B was asked about his whereabouts, he stated work and provided a time card. However, the time card was proven to be edited, and person B's alibi changed 3 times. Not only did A have domestic disturbance calls to victim one's house, but person B also had domestic violence claims against multiple women and had an obsession with victim one. At the crime scene, there was an article of clothing. The DNA did not match person one, but there is a photo of person B wearing the clothing. Person A did not have a reason to have the murder weapon on their person, but person B needed the murder weapon for their job and also had military training with the murder weapon. Person A had a weak alibi, but person B stated they were working, even though the person's work closed 2 hours earlier, and person B altered their time card with a pencil. Person A and B are both considered aggressive people, however, person A was on the older side and didn't have the strength that they used to, while person B had a known anger disorder that was heightened when off medication, which was proven during the time of the crime. Person A was violent towards one of the victims before, however, person B was jealous of victim 2 as victim 1 chose to be with victim 2 instead of suspect B the night of the murder. Person A didn't have a large amount of DNA evidence at the crime scene, and B was never tested, even though there was unmatched DNA found at the crime scene. B was also seen with random wounds days later that were never explained.
Based on what we know about true crime and what we've talked about on this podcast, who do you think did it? Was it A, after having a weak alibi and previous issues with victim one? Was it suspect B, angered over victim one, choosing someone else over them? Just sit there and think for a minute. Truly think. Is there a chance B could have done it? Are you sitting there saying it could be either? Maybe it was A and B together. Was it just B? Could it be someone else we didn't mention?
Just think for another second. Do you have your answer? If you said person B did it or could have done it, or if you're even wavering and believe there's a chance person B could have done it, you now have doubt that Orenthal James Simpson killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Crime, a true crime podcast hosted by me, Justice, a doctor of forensic psychology,
and me, Rebecca, a criminologist.
You won't find clickbait titles, selfie thumbnails, or spooky music to set the mood here, but what you will find is ethical true crime with extra focus on empathy, accuracy, and a viewpoint from professionals.
So grab your coffee and let's get started.
Welcome to the special episode of Dr. Crime. Today, we're doing our first two-part episode, and we're ending our first season. Trigger warnings for this episode are a lot, but include domestic violence, murder, abuse, and depictions of crime scenes.
I think the best place to start with O.J. Simpson, part one, is to just give kind of a quick history. So, obviously, this didn't happen in Delaware. We added that because it's important to understand that there's a huge bias with this case. So, by changing slight location details, not including names, you can see the case in an unbiased manner and see that there may be more to the story. When most people think of this case, they just think, well, OJ did it, and move on. So, to start, Orenthal James Simpson, otherwise known as OJ or The Juice, is a famous football player here in the U.S. He won the Heisman in 1968 while playing for the University of Southern California and then played for the NFL as a running back for 11 seasons, mostly with the Buffalo Bills. He was an incredible player. He was the first to rush more than 2,000 yards in a season, and he currently holds the record for the highest single-season yards per game average, which is 143.1. He has been inducted into both the Pro and College Football Halls of Fame. In 1985, 5 years after retiring from professional football, he married Nicole Brown, who was a waitress at a club in Beverly Hills. The couple met when Nicole was just 18 years old and became inseparable. They had become an icon of love, where it seems like they really had a fairy tale life. However, the relationship didn't stay a fairy tale forever. Nicole and OJ had numerous blowout fights. They took numerous breaks in their marriage as well. The first break didn't last too long, but it started with Nicole stating that she didn't have a life outside of OJ. All of her friends were OJ's friends, and her career was even, you know, because of OJ. They tried getting back together, but again, it didn't last. One New Year's Eve, Nicole and OJ made up and they went to a party. One of their mutual friends talked about getting new diamond earrings, and Nicole thought she was going to get earrings as well. This is according to OJ, so take that with a grain of salt, but... However, Nicole had been drinking and supposedly did drugs that night, and when OJ and Nicole went to have sex, she asked if she could have the earrings. According to OJ, he was confused and said he didn't know what she was talking about. They started yelling at each other, and OJ told her to sleep on the couch. She kicked him out and then locked the door. Then again, according to OJ, Nicole unlocked the door with a spare key and jumped on OJ and tried hitting him. He stated that he did push her to the ground and then grabbed her arm and pulled her out of the room and locked the door again. OJ stated that Nicole then continued screaming about how upset she was and how he needs to let her in the room so the kids don't wake up, but OJ didn't open the door. He finally heard silence and woke up to his housekeeper telling him that the police were at the door, called by Nicole. The police asked Nicole if he'd heard her, and she stated no, which this was verified by a police report, and charges were filed for spousal abuse. Then Nicole decided to drop any charges brought against him. This was known as the New Year's event because, according to OJ, it was one of only two times that he ever laid a hand on her.
The on-again and off-again really makes me think of the statistic that it takes the average domestic abuse victim 7 times to successfully leave the relationship. So, yeah.
I didn't know that. That's really sad.
Yeah.
The other time that OJ allegedly laid a hand on her was the night that she and him got into another argument because he had mentioned that he didn't like her friends. He stated that she started dressing slutty and doing too many drugs. He didn't want her around that lifestyle and didn't want his kids around it either. This caused a massive fight, and she locked him out of the house in which he started screaming. This is the fight that led to Nicole calling the police. OJ had gotten angry and started breaking her car door. Again, the police were called, but Nicole apologized to OJ and stated she didn't mean what she said.
Which, again, is very consistent with abuse victims. They'll stand up for themselves, they'll call the police, and then immediately crumple down and apologize and say that, you know, they overreacted or they didn't mean to call or, you know, they take the blame for the situation.
I do want to interject because I'm not sure that we've said it, but when Nicole and OJ got married, OJ had actually had a previous marriage. So he was divorced and he had a child. So he had a child from a previous marriage and then they ended up having 2 children together. So when he's talking about his kids, that's what he's talking about. So OJ and Nicole finally broke up for good after trying for a year being together. OJ had a relationship with a woman named Paula, but he ended up leaving Paula to sort of try and make it work with Nicole again, and Nicole left her partner, but once that year was up, both of them were tired of each other, and they agreed to just co-parent, and that was it. According to some people, Nicole still tried to get back with OJ, but OJ was the one who said he was done. A few friends and family went to OJ to see if he could help with Nicole's drug use, and he stated, quote, "She's not my problem anymore."
It's so sad because Nicole had really cried out for help in more ways than one, and yet feels like people saw the cry for help, but no one really did anything. Clearly, we can even see in his statement, OJ views himself as a victim and feels like that this was all Nicole's fault that tore them apart, which is very common in abusive relationships. We see that OJ was very controlling, where he was upset with who she was hanging out with, what she was wearing, what she was doing, etc. I will say I do kind of understand not liking the, you know, drug usage around the kids. I mean, I think any parent wouldn't want that. But I don't think that how he handled it was appropriate. And I definitely think that he kind of over-exaggerated that part to make himself look good.
Yeah, I think we can all definitely agree their marriage was tumultuous. There were several police reports filed for domestic violence, like we mentioned. OJ was allegedly disgusted with Nicole as she gained pregnancy weight and made this known. He was physically violent towards her. In some of the reports, like, it says they told doctors she fell off a bike when actually he'd put hands on her. 911 audio would later come out where Nicole told dispatchers she was afraid for her own safety due to OJ's physical abuse. Despite the tumultuous marriage, or because of the tumultuous marriage, Nicole filed for divorce in 1992.
Did OJ's first wife ever report any domestic violence or any abuse in their relationship?
Interestingly, no. So she went on 2020 with Barbara Walters, and she said that she didn't think OJ was capable of harming anyone, and that he'd never so much as laid a finger on her during their 12 years of marriage.
It's so interesting because abusers don't really come out of nowhere. You'll see abusive tendencies even in their teenage first sets of relationship, even if it doesn't escalate. However, his first wife was much closer to OJ's age, and she had been there like before he got famous. So it's possible he developed those habits as he aged, and you know, he kind of had like that control over her because she was so young. However, it is kind of odd to go from the first wife saying there was absolutely nothing, would never hurt anybody, to a murder trial.
Ah, yes. So, the murders. That all begins the night of June 12th, 1994, into the early morning hours of June 13th, 1994. These events are all, of course, based on testimony that we're going to talk about more during the trial portion of this episode. So keep in mind, this is 2 years after Nicole and OJ's divorce. At 6 p.m. on June 12th, Nicole Brown Simpson and OJ left separately from their daughter Sydney's dance recital at Paul Revere Junior High School. At this recital, OJ had sat separately from his ex-wife and her family. Many people would later say that he looked angry and upset, but there are pictures of OJ leaving this event, and he appears to be smiling and talking with everyone. It was revealed later that OJ did allegedly make a comment to Brian Cato Kalin, who is a friend of the family who was staying in his guest house, that Nicole was wearing very tight clothing. It was also stated that OJ had become angry because he heard a report from mutual friends at the recital that Nicole had a cocaine addiction that was so out of hand that there was no end in sight. At 6:30 p.m., Nicole and nine of her friends and family went to dinner at the Mezzaluna restaurant, which was an Italian spot in Brentwood, California. OJ did not go with them. They stayed there until 8 o'clock p.m. when Nicole and her children left the restaurant and stopped for ice cream on the way home. At 9:15 p.m., a member of Nicole's family called the Mezzaluna restaurant to report that Nicole's mother had left her glasses there, and a young staff member named Ron Goldman offered to return them to Nicole's condo.
So did Ron and Nicole know each other?
So there's a lot of rumors around their relationship. Because they were found together, many people assumed that they were in a romantic relationship, which, of course, everyone knows how crazy the OJ trial got. But the tabloids in this case totally fed into that assumption. Including the Baltimore Sun, which described them as being in an increasingly close relationship. But there isn't any proof that they were romantically intertwined in any way or anything more than just friends. They did go out to coffee and dinner sometimes, but they were friends. And they were also part of a similar friend group, which kind of explains them going to, like, parties and stuff.
Right, yeah. So it makes sense that he's the one willing to drop it off. Like, he knows Nicole. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't he?
Right. So he says he'll drop it off. And then at 9:10, so right around the same time that that's happening, OJ and his friend Cato, who we mentioned, they went and grabbed some McDonald's for dinner in OJ's Rolls Royce. They entered the drive-thru lane at 9:22 and returned home at 9:45. When they got home, they went their separate ways. Like I mentioned, Cato was staying in the guest house, so he wasn't in the main house. At 9:48, Ron Goldman left the Mezzaluna with the glasses in a white envelope. And at 10:15, Nicole Brown Simpson's neighbors heard her dog barking and crying repeatedly while they were trying to watch TV. And the dog whining would be heard by, like, a few different people. Yeah. At 10:25, Alan Park, who was a limousine driver, arrived at OJ's house to take him to the Chicago airport. Now, let's make a quick note here that when he arrived, Alan did not see OJ's infamous white Bronco at the house. So Alan waited 15 minutes before buzzing the intercom several times and not getting a response. At 10:40, Cato heard some strange thumping noises coming from, like, the main house, so he left the guest house to go investigate. At 10:55, Alan called his boss and informed him that he couldn't get a hold of OJ. His boss told him to just kind of wait it out until 11:15 because OJ was notoriously late. Right before 11, so, like, less than 5 minutes later, Alan sees a white male carrying a flashlight, that's Cato, and a 6-foot, 200-pound black individual walking across the driveway towards the street.
So the 6 foot person and Cato were walking together?
No. So Cato was walking towards Alan, and the other individual was across the driveway and allegedly entered the house. Cato asked Alan if OJ had overslept, and he asked him if he'd felt an earthquake because of the strange thumping. Right after this conversation, at 11 o'clock, Alan buzzes the intercom again, and OJ answered, saying that he'd overslept and he would be right down. He comes down a few minutes later, and he and Cato help load his 5 suitcases into the limousine. At 11:15, the limousine leaves for LAX, and it arrives at 11:35. 10 minutes later, OJ leaves on an American Airlines flight to Chicago.
Why was OJ even going to Chicago?
He was traveling to Chicago for a Hertz rental car convention. So by this point, OJ had been retired from football for a while. So he was like a spokesperson for Hertz. He was kind of like a TV personality. So he was going for that convention. But shortly after his flight left at 12:10 a.m., Nicole's white Akita was found wandering the neighborhood with bloody paws and a bloody belly, dragging its own leash. A man who was walking his own dog attempted to let the dog sort of back into its yard, and this is when the bodies of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman are discovered outside of her condo, brutally murdered. So, before we go further, I'm going to describe the scene. The condo itself was not damaged in any way. The master bedroom was lit with candles, the bathtub was full, like Nicole was planning on relaxing. The TV was on, there was a half-melted cup of ice cream on the banister, and Nicole's children were unharmed, asleep in their beds.
I do want to mention here that the fact that the candles were lit and a bath was drawn, it is believed that Nicole was supposed to have a romantic partner over, because it did kind of, that scene was kind of set. At this point, Nicole had been seeing other people, as had OJ, so people believe that he saw that she might be about to get romantic with someone, and totally lost it. So
no, definitely. It's also interesting because it's just such a different perspective, because to me, the first thing I thought was she wants alone time from her kids.
Right.
Okay. Outside of the condo, unfortunately, was a very different story, but blood covered the partially hidden walkway and flowed down the stone steps. 34-year-old Nicole was sprawled out on the steps, and 26-year-old Ron Goldman was found in the shrubbery a few feet away. Both victims were fully clothed, and they both had been stabbed to death. Nicole's death was ruled a homicide by multiple sharp force injuries. Her autopsy describes her injuries as a gaping incised wound of the neck, which cut both her left and right carotid and her left and right jugular veins. So in layman's terms, she had her throat slit to the point where she was almost decapitated. It was a very deep wound. Mm-hmm. She had 4 stab wounds to the left side of the neck, 3 inches below the ear. She had multiple other non-fatal stab wounds to the right and left of her scalp, and she suffered a blunt force injury to the head and also had several defensive wounds to her hands. Ron's death was also ruled a homicide by multiple sharp force injuries. His autopsy revealed a sharp force wound to the left side of his neck that severed his left jugular vein and multiple stab wounds to the chest, abdomen, and his left thigh. He also had non-fatal stab wounds to his scalp, face, neck, and also had defensive wounds to his hands and upper extremities. The medical examiner who performed their autopsies stated that the wounds were extremely precise and that they appeared to have been made by a large man. So I think that we can see this crime was one committed out of intense emotion just by the injury pattern. What else does this tell you from a forensic psych perspective?
Well, if you've listened to the podcast, you will know that stabbing that many times is not self-defense. It is not a quick maneuver to rob someone, that this is overkill. There's emotions attached. The killer clearly wanted them dead, and this was a huge release of pent-up anger and aggression. This leads me to believe that this is someone who is attached to the victims that did this, whether it was Nicole or Ron. However, because forensically, it seemed that Nicole was stabbed first, then Ron, then the killer went back to Nicole, and this happened at Nicole's house. This leads me to believe that the killer was actually more after Nicole, more so than Ron. The crime also happened outside, meaning that this was a disorganized killing and that this was impulsive. This was not planned, and the person didn't have the intention of killing them. Again, the killer had done this right outside Nicole's house. It wasn't like in the middle of the woods. It wasn't secluded. So the killer could have just gone in the house and committed the crime, but they did it outside. So that really shows just how impulsive this was, just how angry this person was. However, the overkill on Ron could be from one of two reasons. One is that the killer also had it out for Ron for the same reason. In this case, people believe the killer thought Ron was the one Nicole was waiting for and was jealous. And whereas the second reason is that Ron put up a huge fight, which we know from his training and defensive wounds. Ron Goldman was a triple black belt, so he knew defense maneuvers. And that the person was on a high from wounding Nicole and took out the initial anger on Ron before going back to killing Nicole.
Did either one of them even have enough time to try and defend themselves?
Well, here's where I kind of wonder about some of the things at the crime scene. As you just said, Ron was a triple black belt in karate, meaning he has mastered self-defense. And his hands are pretty banged up. There was lots of cuts, lots of bruises. So it shows that he did try very hard to defend himself, and that whoever attacked him would definitely have wounds on themselves.
So, spoiler alert, the person that the authorities think attacked them was OJ. So yep. Were there any self-defense marks on OJ? Like, I mean, if a triple black belt is going to defend themselves, I'm assuming the other person's going to have some marks.
Right. And this is where, looking objectively, I kind of questioned a little bit of something, because OJ didn't have any defensive marks. He had one cut on his hand. It wasn't deep. He didn't even need stitches. Granted, he couldn't tell where that cut came from, but to have a triple black belt fight you?
Speaking of Ron being able to defend himself, didn't OJ actually also have really bad arthritis?
Yes, even the day of the murder, he was seen limping and having extreme issues with arthritis and mobility, which we'll talk more about that in part two. Not only was the crime scene indicating it was clearly someone who knew the offender, they clearly had a personal vendetta. Stabbing is a very highly sexualized form of killing, meaning the killer likely had a sexual obsession or fantasy with her. That's not 100% of the time, but when you can see, like, that's kind of the most common. This person is extremely impulsive. They don't care about how the public views them, because, again, they're doing this outside. So clearly their self-image, they're thinking about something else than their self-image. You can tell that because the kill, again, was very public, and that the kill happened in a moment. It was very impulsive, and the person saw red when they were committing the crime. This person might have even slipped into a psychosis for a moment because of the anger, the aggression, the red. Like, just seeing red is the only way I can, like, put that type of anger. It's, like, almost blacking out, coming into this just sense of such a high form of emotion. And the person would have had to have the knife on them naturally because, again, the kills happened outside. If the kills happened on the inside, someone maybe broke in to kill them. Maybe someone had let themselves in, but it happened outside. So this to me is kind of telling me that the person's intention wasn't to go over and to kill, because they wouldn't have done that outside. They would have planned it better for them to be on the inside. So it wasn't the person was going to go over and kill Nicole, but something definitely set them over the edge when they arrived at the scene. And I think that that is kind of why maybe seeing the scene of, like, a romantic partner's coming over could have set off the killer.
That makes sense. I hadn't really thought about that. That, yeah, there was no break-in or anything. So that person, if the crime scene doesn't indicate that they were going over there with the intention to kill, they would have just had to have a knife on them.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to the timeline, at 5 a.m., Detectives Mark Furman and Philip Vinatter arrive at the Simpson house with the intention of telling him that his ex-wife is dead. OJ was not home, but the lights were on and there were several vehicles in the driveway, including OJ's white Bronco. Police allegedly observed a blood stain on the Bronco and blood leading to the house. They also found the infamous bloody glove that matched a glove found at the murder scene at Ron's feet. We'll talk a lot more about these gloves in part two of this episode. The officers attempted to contact OJ, but after receiving no answer, they decided the best course of action would be to jump the fence and to just let themselves in. They woke up Cato first in the guest house, and they examined his shoes to see if they matched bloody footprints that were found at the scene, or bloody shoe prints that were found at the scene. But they didn't. So they had Cato take them to OJ's daughter Arnell's quarters, and she took the police to the main house, and they ended up calling Kathy Rhonda, who's OJ's longtime assistant, to arrange for care of the children and to sort of help get in touch with OJ. At 6 a.m., OJ was notified of his ex-wife's murder, and by 6:30, he checked out of the O'Hare Plaza Hotel and headed back to the airport to fly back to L.A. While he was doing this, criminologists secured both the scene of the crime and OJ's home and began the process to obtain search warrants. At 7 to 7:30 a.m., the area was declared a crime scene and the warrant to search OJ's home was granted.
Now, as a criminologist, what is the proper way to secure a crime scene?
Well, first things first, they would want to block it off to the public and then start photographing everything. And, of course, we've also talked about this in multiple cases before, but this also includes making sure the people that come into the crime scene have, you know, booties on, have hairnets on, have gloves on to make sure they're not contaminating anything. Then they would start looking around for evidence like clothing, things out of place, weapons, anything missing from the house. They would also have a unit that would start taking fingerprints as well as collecting DNA evidence found at the crime scene. And then they would start looking at things like blood spatter and, you know, starting the analysis.
Gotcha. Now, as a criminologist, how do you feel about how they secured the scene? While we go over some in part two, there's definitely what your thoughts on the crime scene.
Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit more about this in the next part as well, but I think we cover this a lot where the first people that come into a crime scene really can make or break the case, right? So, like I just mentioned, coming in and contaminating evidence, coming in and not being authorized was a big problem in this case. So there were unauthorized individuals that didn't really have a business being there, like inside the Bronco, touching stuff inside the Bronco. There was all kinds of evidence that was missing. So like fingerprints were missing. And then there was a bunch of stuff. Again, we'll talk about it more, but like with the blood and DNA evidence that was collected, where like the blood at the scene and the blood in the vial didn't match, or it was like obviously at a different point in like time, so they weren't from the same time period. And because of that, it opened up a lot of conspiracy theories in this case to the police tampering with evidence intentionally. A big thing was the gloves. So the gloves were not stored the proper way. I know properly what you're supposed to do is if anything has blood on it, you put it in a paper bag, seal it, and label it. That did not happen in this case, so...
Nope. So with all of that being said about, like, the crimes and what happened after the search warrant was granted? What did they find?
So we're going to talk about what they found a little bit more later, but OJ did finally arrive home at 11:08. He was immediately handcuffed and escorted to the LAPD headquarters, where he was questioned for 3.5 hours. He was accompanied by his attorney, Howard Weitzman.
What was OJ's initial statement to the police? What was his response?
It's very long, but in a nutshell, he told them that after Sydney's dance recital, he drove his Rolls Royce home, and then he got into the Bronco to go see his girlfriend, Paula. But when he went to go see her, he, like, wasn't able to get in contact with her, so he just came home to hang out with Cato at around 8-something. They went to go get some McDonald's, and then he'd just come back home. When they asked him about the injury to his hand, first he said that he didn't know how he got it, and then he said he'd cut it when reaching into his Bronco, and then in Chicago, he'd been holding a glass when he was told about Nicole's death, and he just kind of went bonkers for a little bit and reopened it. He said that he may have bled in the Bronco, but he couldn't really remember. He went on to describe his relationship with Nicole in the statement, their previous domestic violence issues, but he basically summed it up that they did not communicate anymore unless it was about their children. He didn't go into her house. He didn't ask questions about her behavior. Nothing.
Did he mention anything about Ron Goldman?
No, weirdly, not even once during the initial interview. The interview, though, it didn't really cover, like, any relevant information whatsoever. Not the way you would think an initial interview following, like, a gruesome murder scene discovery would go. They didn't ask him about his alibi. They didn't ask him anything, really. They asked about the cut, and that was just about the most relevant thing. Other than that, it was, like, a history on him and Nicole. The interview didn't like I said, it didn't cover really any relevant information. So the following day, the coroner's official report was released and police began their search and seizure of the Simpson home. On June 15th, Robert Shapiro took over for Howard Weitzman as OJ's defense attorney. 2 days later, OJ was charged with 2 counts of murder with special circumstances, and the prosecution announced that they may be seeking the death penalty. The prosecution worked out a deal with Shapiro, which was that OJ was to turn himself into the LAPD headquarters by 10 a.m. on the morning of June 17th, which was the day after Nicole's funeral. This was mostly done to protect his celebrity image. You know, it would be such a big tabloid thing if people saw the police show up and drag OJ out. So they just said, hey, you can come turn yourself in. But OJ didn't show up. So the police agreed to show up at his house at 1 p.m. to pick him up. And when they showed up to get him, it was discovered that OJ was not there. And I just want to mention that this was a surprise to everyone at the house, including Shapiro.
Yeah.
He'd left a letter that everyone assumed was a suicide note that ended with, "Don't feel sorry for me. I've had a great life, great friends. Please think of the real OJ and not this lost person. Thanks for making my life special. I hoped I helped yours. Peace and love, OJ." Despite 2 other similar notes being found, OJ had, of course, not committed suicide, but was instead on the run, preparing for the most famous car chase in history.
Ah, yes, the infamous Bronco chase.
The very one. So, OJ, complete with a fake beard and mustache, almost $9,000 in cash, a loaded gun, and his passport, accompanied his best friend, AC Cowlings, in his white Bronco.
So, according to OJ, he was going to commit suicide, but AC had stopped him. However, we know that's not the case. He had a disguise, he had money, he had a passport. Like, we all know he was going to run away. But again, this is just according to OJ that it was a suicide note. He was going to commit suicide. And then after AC had stopped him, AC then made a call to someone that he was with OJ and was going to force him to turn himself in. So that is when AC started driving his Bronco. And it wasn't OJ's Bronco like people believe.
Correct. AC just happened to also have a white Bronco, which makes sense. The white Bronco wasn't OJ's personal vehicle. It was a company car from Hertz. Also, weird side note, in my research, I found that OJ's first wife was actually originally dating AC when she met OJ, which is just kind of weird. But anyways, around 6:20, OJ and AC were spotted on the highway in the Bronco, with AC driving and OJ in the backseat, and the police were notified. This chase was broadcasted live, famously interrupting the NBA Finals. And it's estimated that 95 million people watched it live. People also gathered on the highway overpasses and cheered OJ on. Some people even made signs. The chase was very slow moving. It took 45 minutes. It was not considered a high-speed chase, though some people believe differently. It was this slow because OJ allegedly was holding a gun to his head. So police tailed the car, but no one wanted to escalate the situation, and AC didn't want anything to happen, so he kept the chase to low speed. Police cars and helicopters followed OJ back to his home, and this is when the negotiations began. By the way, you can watch the entire chase on YouTube if you're curious. It's not that exciting, but it's available.
So was AC ever charged with the involvement for this?
So... yes, kind of. Also, no. AC was arrested and charged with aiding a fugitive, but prosecutors dropped his charges over lack of evidence. It seems to be a popular thought that if AC was genuinely trying to help OJ escape, he probably wouldn't have, like, gone for a casual drive through the hillside of California. So they took it into account that AC helped negotiate OJ's surrender as well, which took place just before 9 p.m. on June 17th, when OJ Simpson surrendered to the LAPD and exited his home holding a family photo. OJ was arrested for double murder and put in jail without bail, awaiting trial.
And the trial is where we're going to pick up at part 2 of this episode of Dr. Crime. Thank you all so much for listening.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Dr. Crime Pod. We can't wait to talk to you guys in part 2.